Hey, everybody, before we get to the latest We Got This with Mark and Hal, you may already be aware if you follow us on social media or any of our other Maximum Fun sister shows that this is Max Fun Drive. We're going to tell you more about that later on in the show, but I really hope that if you've been listening to us for a while and you have the means to become a member and contribute directly to this show and allow Mark and I to continue doing what we do, that you'll take a moment to do that. You go to MaximumFun.org/donate. You get it set up and only takes about 30 seconds. And make sure, most importantly, and I talk about this a bunch with Mark, We Got This as one of the podcasts you listen to. That is the only way to ensure that we benefit directly from your contribution. And also, we have some stretch goals that are specific for the new and upgrading members who specifically support We Got This. Everything from a live streamed mini episode to a call-in show where you leave us your feedback and we respond to it on the episodes where you agreed or disagreed with the decision. And the big one, of course, is the ability of our listeners to vote on and overturn any decision that we've made in the past 12 months. We're going to put out a fun image that gives you a meter. We'll update you as things go. But until that time, become a member, contribute. If you don't have the means to either upgrade or become a member, spread the word. And if you become a member, let us know on social media. Don't be shy about it. Be proud. We appreciate it so much. Thank you. You're going to hear more about that a little bit later, but first, please enjoy this special Max Fun Drive episode of We Got This with Mark and Hal.
Hello, I'm Hal Lublin.
And I'm Mark Gagliardi.
Since the dawn of humanity, one issue has gone unsettled. With the fate of the world in the balance, we're here to settle once and for all. Best Hanna-Barbera cartoon.
That's right. Don't worry, everyone. We got this.
Podcasts should have a theme song.
Podcasts should not have a theme song.
Yes, they should.
No, they shouldn't.
They sound good.
Yeah, but people are just going to skip past it.
You know what?
You're right. We got this.
Oh, Hal, I have a giant stack of papers in front of me, and most pages of the paper at some point say either Scooby-Doo or Flintstone's New Hour or some sort of insanity. Help me make sense of what is happening right now.
I'm going to do that, but we're not alone.
Oh, thank God.
For goodness sakes. We have the patriarch of the McElroys. The great Clint McElroy.
Clint McElroy. I was wondering who was in my earphones.
I am the pater familia. Yes.
Ah. Ooh.
Clint, you and I met, was it last year?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
It was last year. Instant best friends. Is that weird for me to say?
No. I think it's incredibly accurate.
Yeah.
All right. I'm sorry you both suffer from IBF.
Actually.
Yeah. That's how we bonded. It was in the men's room. Thanks for bringing it up, Mark.
Boom, 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 boom. I don't have any paper over here. Boom, boom, boom. We got a tough luck, pal. Yeah, that was good times. Good times.
It started so contentious, and then we figured it out. We were like...
Like all good buddy movies.
Exactly. We found the common ground after the hate. But you chose to talk about Hanna-Barbera cartoons. This was suggested by Josh Sinison. Thank you, Josh.
Thanks, Josh.
Why'd you choose this?
Because I have always been a huge Hanna-Barbera fan. I can safely say I'm the only one of the three of us who probably watched every one of the first, 30, 40 projects of Hanna-Barbera live on TV.
Right.
Because I lived back in, Civil War times and we didn't have DVRs. And I've always been a huge fan. I don't want to bias the mission here, but absolutely probably my favorite cartoon of all time is a Hanna-Barbera project and the second or third of all time. So, and also because it's very nostalgic for me because kids, there used to be a time where you owned Saturday morning television.
Oh, yeah.
You owned it. It was all for you. And that was such a great time. It was such a cultural touchstone for me and I think the people of my generation. And, I don't even know if they probably still had some Saturday morning cartoons by the time you guys came along as little –
Yeah, 80s and 90s, there were a lot of cartoons.
Yeah, I think we're one of the last generations to really have a concentrated programming block on Saturday mornings just for kids. And there was some Hanna-Barbera in there.
Right. I think the CW was like the last bastion of Saturday morning cartoons.
Yes.
Is there anywhere now that is like, because everything's been so fractured into a million places to find things, you don't have to, like, the big broadcast networks don't have to be like, all right, we got to serve everybody. Kids, this is your big chunk right here. Go. Right. It does feel like the kids of the world have lost some of their power. Not owning Saturday mornings like that.
Yeah. And it really was. I mean, Mom and Dad would sleep in. You come out in your PJs. Yeah. You get those little boxes of cereal that you know, pried open with a, and I mean the little boxes of cereal that you pried the box
ones that
open.
Have the, that have like the built-in bowl, so they
right.
say.
Right. And you just poured the milk in. And of course, it never worked, but we didn't,
No.
And you'd plop down in front of the TV set and watch one of three channels
that Hanna-Barbera somehow managed to squeeze 4,000 cartoons yep. onto
at one point when CBS had one of their Saturday morning blocks. I want to say maybe mid late 70s, and of the 10 hours of programming in that Saturday morning block, six hours belonged to Hanna-Barbera. So
wow,
prodigious in the amount of things that they put out.
And not all of them great.
Yeah, you know, I've been reviewing, our researcher Kate McManus put together, printed out.
God bless you, Kate McManus. This is the aforementioned giant stack that I'm sure you are looking at as well.
I think it's like 12 pages printed out.
Yeah.
But what I've noticed is that Hanna-Barbera cartoons fall into specific buckets. Here are the buckets I figured out. Let me know if I missed any or if I'm inaccurate. One is animals who wear hats and challenge authority figures with no necks.
Right.
Be they police officers or park rangers or pet store owners. Then that sort of covers your Yogi Bear, Huckleberry Hound, Top Cat.
Mm-hmm, right.
Is Wally Gator?
Wally Gator.
Yeah.
Wally Gator.
And a little bit rough.
Wally Gator sounds like the eye in the sky on the local channel. Wally Gator in traffic.
That's right.
Hi, everybody. It's me, Wally Gator.
then you have straight up just lifting intellectual property that exists, because they did Abbott and Costello. They did Laurel and Hardy. They adapted Sinbad into Sinbad Jr. and his magic belt.
Yeah. On and on and on. I mean, they did everything. I mean, they did an Addams Family. They did the Partridge Family 2200 AD.
Yes.
For crying out loud. Godzilla. Yeah. So.
Did they think that kids just wouldn't know? They're like, kids aren't watching the primetime shows. Let's just make a version of Happy Days for them. Call it Fonz and Friends. And, they'll have their version too.
I think it's one of the strengths, honest to God, of Hanna-Barbera. They are not remembered as great animators when it comes to art. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when they came over from MGM from making absolutely beautiful Tom and Jerry cartoons, these guys were out of work because MGM closed their cartoon division in like 1957. So they were visionaries enough to say, hey, you know what? This TV thing, it might just catch on. And they moved. They are really innovators when it comes to the development and production of animation. They came up with a style called, well, they didn't call it limited. They called it planned animation, but it was limited animation.
Right. This is where there was like six frames many.
Yeah, six frames instead of maybe 12. And some of those frames were static, and all they would do would be to animate, say, the mouth. And so they were able to go from spending like, you know, $35,000 for 7 minutes of Tom and Jerry down to, you know, maybe $4,000 for an episode of Rough and Ready or something like that.
Yeah.
So they were these great providers. They came with this great system. And I think the industry, they said, that works. Let's do a whole bunch of that. And, you know, I think people were knocking down their doors to get to them. And like I said, I don't know if I would call them great artists, but I think they were really, really smart about putting together the right kind of people, choosing the right ideas and knowing what would work. And God bless them. I mean, you can't fault for how much they've done. Now, a lot of it, like you said, was redoing things they did that worked.
Right.
But the times where they said, all right, let's do something completely artistic, completely different, were not necessarily big financial successes for them.
So let me ask you this. If we're looking at the best Hanna-Barbera cartoons, what is their, would you consider their Tom and Jerry cartoons to be Hanna-Barbera cartoons? Or are we talking specifically about that golden age once they have figured out this, Hanna-Barbera factory, the best output from that? It does seem like Tom and Jerry are an outlier because those are MGM cartoons.
They didn't create the
characters.
They were working for Harmon Ising, which, believe it or not, really was the name of these two guys. Now, I don't know if you can, because Tom and Jerry were full-blown, full animation. They were like, you know, they would work in this way where Bill would, you know, kick around ideas with Joe, and Joe would act them all out. And then Joe Barbera was this lightning-fast draftsman. And would, you know, start doing sketches and storyboarding and all this other kind of stuff. And then they go back and fill it in. And I don't think it was until they really left where they had complete control over all the product. As much as I love Tom and Jerry, and as huge and important as Tom and Jerry is, I don't know. For one thing, art wise, it just smokes everything they did when they went to television. And it was when they went to television that they became real pioneers, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And I think visually, you know, you mentioned visually, that definitely very simplistic, certainly the early stuff, like Rough and Ready, Top Cat. But when they got into the late 60s, they started to come up with some really interesting, looking stuff. I thought.
Is that your second bucket?
Well, the other bucket.
I'm sorry. I forgot about the buckets.
Animals with tiny hats, right? we have the lifted material from somewhere else. And you might even add the Flintstones to that, although I think it's more inspired by it's definitely the Honeymooners in the Stone Age.
Mm-hmm.
But then
Jackie Gleason thought it was close enough. He actually considered suing.
That's right.
Oh, wow. And, I mean, yeah, it's pretty identical to the Honeymooners.
And his lawyers talked him out of it.
Because it's a real mean thing to do.
Yeah. Do you want to be the guy that took the Flintstones off the air? I mean, there's tons and tons about this. I mean, and they knew it. I mean, the guys that worked on the show even called, you know, Barney Rubble Carney Double, you know, for Art Carney. Yeah. Right. So, almost everything they did was something that they borrowed from. Because they were great. I'll tell you one thing. They had a great strength in observing what worked.
You can tell by their collection of shows. After something is introduced, then, you know, for the next 15 years, they're putting out either repackaged versions or future versions or mashups.
Well, they were also constantly trying to tap into whatever the zeitgeist was. I mean, if you watch something like Chattanooga Cats, which is like a hippie band in a bus traveling from place to place, and whatever adventures happen. That was directly, like, you know what time period it was made because it's a bunch of hippies in a bus.
And they also were kind of innovators, because that's a good example. They were also kind of innovators of, remember, when they first got started, Rough and Ready, Huckleberry Hound, Quick Draw McGraw, all those shows were bookended by the main character with one or two other cartoons sandwiched in between in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And long before, you know, Happy Days spun off Laverne and Shirley and Mork and Mindy, they spun off Yogi Bear, which arguably could be called their most famous creation. Mm-hmm. And so as you go on and on, you can look at these books, you look at the shows, a lot of the characters would then spin off into their own shows that just because they were so huge.
It was almost like they were comic book, like they were a comic book publisher, in that they created this universe. This universe existed. They created this bullpen of characters that they could bring out and put into any combination, which is why I always loved Laugh Olympics growing up.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Back when I was a kid at Universal Studios in Florida, they had what now is like the Shrek 4D ride, They had the Fantastic World of Hanna-Barbera, and it's basically just a roller coaster with all of their characters. You're riding with Yogi Bear.
Kings Island was the same thing. Kings Island for a while was a Hanna-Barbera, you know, had a lot of Hanna-Barbera themed themed rides too. It just, you know, and when we went through the Smurf ride, I wanted to drown myself. my family talked me out of it.
Let's talk about the Smurfs, because the Smurfs, how is Hanna-Barbera associated with the Smurfs? Because they were Swedish, weren't they?
They were Belgian.
Yeah.
Belgian.
Peyo, the guy that created them, it was actually, I want to say Fred Silverman, because Fred Silverman was very influential, was a big executive at NBC, and one of his kids said, Daddy, you ought to get these characters, and they jumped on it. It apparently took them a long time to get the rights for them. I have to admit that I was never a huge Smurfs fan. It's one of those things where, I mean, it had the Hanna-Barbera name on it.
Mm-hmm.
But, oh, man, I don't
know. It doesn't feel like one of theirs.
No, it doesn't. It feels like Peyo. And this is the thing to understand about Hanna-Barbera, everybody, is the fact that these guys created this studio. They created this process. They created what I understand is everything I've read is a great work environment, very relaxed. I mean, anytime you have a business, you're going to have people who are, you know, unhappy with stuff. Mark Evanier had some problems with Joe Barbera, but still, you know, is a huge fan of his.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so they were project managers, but they got their hands, they always got their hands dirty, even up into their 70s when they were still going into the studios every day. You know, they had a lot of hands-on work with a lot of these things, but a lot of these projects, you know, if you looked at them strictly through the artwork, you know, a lot of the things were not necessarily, you know, Bill and Joe getting in there and drawing cells and doing all the other stuff.
Right.
So to me, I wouldn't put Smurfs in my top 40.
Well, also that horrifying earworm of a song.
Yes.
Oh,
I wasn't going to do it, Clint.
Oh, listen, I can't help myself. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because one of the coolest things about Hanna-Barbera, and we can get into that later, is the music for their cartoons were amazing. A man named Hoyt Curtin, who came on, I think Huckleberry Hound was the first show he worked on. Mm-hmm. And this is maybe that's kind of a nice underlining for what they did. It was because Hanna-Barbera would say, okay, we need the best people to do this. We need the best people to do that. We need the best people to do this. And, you know, they wouldn't always give the credit to those people.
Sure.
Right.
But, you know, they always picked the best people.
But they worked them and worked them hard. Like, legendary voice actors like Dawes Butler and Paul Frees.
Oh, Don Messick.
Yes.
Mike Rode. Oh, just incredible lineup. Mel Blanc, for God's sake.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great – well, I'm sorry. I'm jumping ahead of myself. There's a great story about Mel Blanc when we get to the Flintstones. Remind me.
Well, should we dive into some of these choices then?
Was that all your buckets?
Well, no. There's a few more.
Oh, my God.
One is good-looking white kids on adventures with malnourished dogs. Scooby-Doo sort of fits into this, but not really, because Scooby-Doo ate a lot. But there are a series of shows. Let me see. Let me find one.
The Club.
Just at random. The Impossibles were a band that turned into superheroes.
They were superheroes.
Clue Club.
Clue Club is two,
you could count
is two bloodhounds.
Funky Phantom.
Oh, yeah. The Funky
Phantom. That was a ghost instead of a dog.
Mark, do you know the Funky Phantom?
I don't know the Funky Phantom. Is that a dance move?
No. Everybody go, first of all, any show you hear us mention, go to YouTube, search for the title and watch the opening sequence, because the opening sequence tells you what every show is about.
Yeah.
So this is a group of kids.
Did that guy write, the composer you mentioned, did he write all of the theme songs, or was that a separate thing?
He wrote a whole ton of the theme songs. They said Hoyt Curtin, there were some times where they would call him and Bill Hanna would write lyrics for a lot of songs. Magilla, Guerrilla, and all of his friends say so long, so long. And Rough and Ready, Always Tough and Steady. I can do them all.
That sounded like the same song. They just wrote different lyrics for that one.
Well, that was my delivery.
That's fair.
There were times they said where Hoyt Curtin would write a theme song over the phone. So, how about this?
You just say it.
Yeah, he was amazing.
Scooby Dooby Doo, yeah. Where are you?
Good. I'm very proud of you.
Yeah, let me pull out my electric bass. So going back to these kids, the Funky Phantom.
Oh, the Funky Phantom
is about a group of kids who are trying to get out of the rain. So they go to this house and set a clock to midnight, and then a Revolutionary War ghost comes out with his ghost cat, and then they're like, "Hey, we're at your service." So now the kids ride around in their buggy. There are a lot of dune buggies. That's a very theme ahead of barbaric kids and dune buggies. And the ghost helps them. He pulls the rug out from under monsters. The cat turns invisible and trips animals. It's beautiful. Yeah, but there are
Is the villain always a villain plus the villain's animal sidekick?
Yeah. Not always. Sometimes it would actually be something weird. I think you could make an argument for Josie and the Pussycats, being along the same kind of lines.
They did a few bands, I guess. You could do an entire music festival of just bands from Hanna-Barbera cartoons. Josie and the Pussycats could play.
Yeah.
The Chattanooga Cats could play.
The Impossibles.
Yep, they were. Yeah.
Bam Bam and Pebbles. They're bands. Right. I mean, the
weird Partridge Family cartoon that they made.
Yep.
2020.
Yep. No, 2200, right?
Oh, 2200 AD. Yeah, you're right.
2020 is just one short year away. I wonder if there'll be a Partridge Family next year.
But then I believe
the Globetrotters had a dog sidekick too.
Yes, they did. And the dog
was the dog named Sweet Georgia Brown?
You know what? The dog's name was Please Feed Me. Like all these dogs, when you see these dogs, you just hear Sarah McLachlan in your head. You hear it. I can't help it. I'm sorry.
Wow.
Thank you.
All right. What other categories do we have?
Those are the main ones, I think. We'll get into more adventure. But go ahead.
I think you need, I think they're an action adventure. They had a period where they said to themselves, I don't want to do any more funny animals. Let's do something with humans.
This is in the mid-70s, yeah?
Right, yeah. And they really started, you know, they went into a whole thing. Late 60s, they went into a whole thing. They transitioned with, like, Adamant and Secret Squirrel, which were funny animals, but Adamant was a superhero, and Secret Squirrel and Morocco Mole were spies. And then they kind of went into a whole thing where they did action heroes, and that... It was successful for them, but it wasn't long before that got squashed too. But we can get to that. We get to that.
Yes. There's so much here to discuss. I feel like we're not going to talk about every single cartoon on this list.
But it sounds like you know phases of what they were doing. Like a grand – I didn't realize there was such a grand sweeping arc. Like, you know, Picasso had his blue period and then the Beatles went to India. Like there are big shifts. There are sort of seismic shifts like that within.
You know, it's funny. I look at it and go, well, the stuff in the 80s was more for kids. But that's not true. It was always for kids.
Right.
But at that time, they were doing more cutesy stuff. So you got like Pac-Man, Trollkins.
Yeah. Really spin-off adaptations. Yeah.
Yes. Oh, Laverne and Shirley had two animated series, one where they were in the army and then one where they were not. There's the Mork and Mindy, Laverne and Shirley, and Fonz Hour.
There was My Dream of Jeannie. There was a My Dream of Jeannie show.
Why do they not do this now? Why are there not just animated versions of all of the sitcoms on television?
Because
watch a Brooklyn Nine-Nine cartoon.
Canon, man. Too many canon, folks. Guys, there was a Gary Coleman show.
Yeah.
Yes.
The Gary Coleman show based on The Kid with the Broken Halo. The Dukes, there's a Dukes of Hazzard show.
Dukes of Hazzard. Funny thing about the Gary Coleman show, was reading in Bill Hanna's book, which is an excellent book, by the way. If you get a chance, it really, if you're an animation fan, it's called A Cast of Friends, that he wrote, but he tells a story about when they did the Gary Coleman show. These animators apparently had no life whatsoever. outside of everything, they said, you need to get down here right now. We got the first test footage of the Gary Coleman show. You got to see, there's something terribly wrong. They ran downstairs. They had drawn him as a white kid.
Oh, no.
Oh, wow. Oh,
now, how do you do a Gary Coleman show and not know what Gary Coleman looks like?
Yeah.
It's insane.
It's a problem.
Sorry, I just thought I'd throw that little bon mot out there.
No, but that's
pretty great.
I think their action hero stuff is a definite phase that really and truly was done. It was hugely successful. I mean, really and truly. I mean, we're talking Space Ghost, the Herculoids. You know, those Luddites in outer space.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They were one of the highest rated shows of all time on Saturday mornings, pulling like a 50 share.
Wow.
A 50 share. Nobody gets anywhere close to that. And they had a lot of success with these and people loved them. And then you had ACT come along. Children's Television, Alliance for Children's Television or whatever, cracked down on Saturday morning cartoons and vitamins, children's vitamins, mm-hmm. and clamored they take a lot of the violence out of cartoons, out of the vitamins, because some of them had like gashes and scars.
Tiny and that vitamin really, with a switchblade in
that was
Flintstones. Sorry.
Well, that's please. How you cut them in half, right?
Yeah.
Before they cut you in half.
And that moved them into a whole nother period. And I think each one of those periods had their big moments. These guys just wanted to, when they first started out, they just wanted to make people laugh. It was all about the gags.
Mm-hmm.
All about the gags. And so they noticed a weird thing that started with really kind of the Huckleberry Hound show. Huckleberry Hound was their first, the first TV show to, well, for one thing, it won an Emmy. It was the first half hour cartoon show made exclusively for TV. Rough and Ready had been cartoons, but Huckleberry Hound was the first one made exclusively for television. Hmm. And it was a huge success. Not only did it win an Emmy award, but it became like this cultural phenomenon. I remember reading this one story about this bar in San Francisco that was mostly college kids. But which, you know, now all bars are, but this bar would ring a bell at 5 minutes till six. And at 6 o'clock, they'd turn the television behind the bar on to the Huckleberry Hound show. And they had a big sign that said, you know, guests will please refrain from tinkling of ice during the Huckleberry Hound show.
Man.
And when they started getting research, they found out that 40% of the people that were watching were adults. Which really...
I should hope so. Wait, only 40% of the people in that bar were adults?
No, watching the show overall. Gotcha. No, there were some 10-year-olds that were, you know, nursing their drinks.
Six out of 10 in this bar.
Sitting in the back, you know, with their Shirley Temples.
Yeah.
No, 40% of the audience was adults that were tuning in for the show, which led them directly to developing the Flintstones.
Wow. And that sort of changed the game as a prime time, like fully prime time animated series. Now, do you want to tell your Mel Blanc story? Now we're at the Flintstones. Ooh.
Well, Flintstones, for those of you who don't know, went through a lot of iterations. They knew they wanted to do a takeoff of the Honeymooners. No doubt about it. They wanted to use mm-hmm. the Honeymooners as their template for doing this. And they went through all these different variations. And by this time, they had like 250 people working for them in Hanna-Barbera Studios. Because they've been very successful, Rough and Ready, Huckleberry Hound, Quick Draw McGraw. And so when they were developing the Flintstones, this was going to be the first primetime animated series on TV. They went and got deals. You can probably find some of the commercials online of Fred and Wilma smoking cigarettes.
Oh, yeah. Those are a fun YouTube dive.
Yeah. So they developed the Flintstones. They tried all these different iterations. They went to Roman times and they went to
Holy
Pilgrims and in the Knights in Armor, and nothing really clicked. And
football players, too.
Football players ended up being, which they ended up developing into a series later on.
Yeah.
But they had one artist. Dan Gordon was his name. He drew a sketch because they were taking ideas from everybody. He drew a sketch of two cavemen standing next to a record player, a Stone Age record player, with the bird with the sharp beak, and his beak was the needle on the phonograph player. And that sketch inspired them to do the Flintstones, which were originally the Gladstones. And then the Flagstones.
Mm-hmm.
They got sued over that. They couldn't use the Flagstones because of a comic strip called High and Lois where the characters were named Flagston.
Yes. Yes.
So they created the Flintstones. And Alan Reed, Joan Van Pyle, B. Benaderet, and Mel Blanc was the voice of Barney Rubble. And Mel Blanc was in a terrible car accident. I mean, that he was not supposed to. This was, I think, still in the first season, maybe into the second season. Terrible car accident that they didn't think he was going to live. So they had somebody come in and do a fill-in voice for like three or four episodes. And then he insisted that they rig up microphones. This guy's in a, he survived. He's in a body cast in a hospital bed in his home. And insisted they bring microphones down and he would do
Mel,
Barney's
take a
voice
break.
From a hospital bed. It's show business, baby.
Jeez, no kidding.
And the Flintstones was hated by the critics. They ravaged them.
Because no one would believe that there was a live studio audience there and they had a laugh track, for God's sake.
And yet the viewers absolutely loved them.
Yeah.
Loved the Flintstones. It was a huge success for them.
Sure. Then, and they are still making all the way up through, Cave Kids in 96.
Oh, yeah.
They were creating new.
Well, 94, a live action movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there were two or three.
There were at least two because the second was Viva Rock Vegas.
That's right.
Was that with Moranis, or was he in the first one?
No,
the first Moranis one was first Goodman one. And Moranis, and the second one was
not Mark Addy. Mark Addy and Stephen Baldwin.
Oh, okay.
That's right, Stephen Baldwin
and Jane Kaczmarek, I think, played Betty.
Oh my God! And
I mean,
Halle
that's
Berry?
A pretty great cast.
Was Halle Berry in the first one?
In the first one,
Halle
yeah.
Berry was in the first.
She
one.
Was Kyle MacLachlan's secretary.
Oh my gosh!
By the way, he's got like the perfect because he's Kyle MacLachlan.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he's got the perfect Flintstone name.
There you go.
No rock.
What would your Flintstones names be?
Wow.
You'd be Clint McElrock, right?
Yeah, that was.
Or Flint McElrock.
Flint McElrock. Yeah.
Yes, that's it. Yeah.
Which is not as good as Ann Margarock.
Yeah, that's pretty great. Geez. And Rock Hard Rock. They just couldn't leave well enough alone. They couldn't. I think what we should do is maybe each come up with, just because there are so many, each come up with our with a top three.
Top three? Wow, I think
we're, and then okay. We can go from there. I think we may have some crossover, but sort of each nominate three finalists, and then...
Well, wait a minute. Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
What criteria do you want to use?
That's a good question. I think...
Because it can't... Because, look, this show is objective answers to subjective questions,
yes.
Al. We can't just go with our opinions.
I agree. I think we're looking for things that are long-lasting.
I think that's the ones that we've already been talking about as... That became tent poles of Hanna-Barbera. We've already mentioned a few of them.
So influence.
Game changers. Influence. Yeah, influence.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, cultural impact for sure. Right.
Game changers, cultural impact. Okay.
Quality. I think just the quality of the show.
Okay.
All right.
Because they are of varying degrees of quality.
Yeah. They're never going to get accused. Hanna-Barbera would never get accused of being fine art. I mean, because that was not their strength. Their strength was this planned animation that they used, with fewer frames and, like I said, overlaying the mouth. But if you're talking quality overall, that meant they had to have better writing. They had to have the gags were funnier. The actual camera work had
that's
to be
more of
sharper.
What I was. That's more of what I meant. Not necessarily the animation itself, but specifically the writing, the characters, I like that you mentioned the camera work because that makes Scooby-Doo jump into my mind immediately because the camera work in Scooby-Doo was always like they were making a funny action show.
Exactly.
And so they needed cool camera work and chase scenes and all of the tropes that you think of being part of Scooby-Doo. They needed that.
And some of the some of the shortcuts they had to use ended up benefiting them on things like that. You know,
the run back and forth.
Yeah, the run back and forth, the come to a sliding stop, mm-hmm. you know, that instead of showing somebody's legs animated moving, no, that you come to a sliding stop. The crossover is one of my favorites, and they all do this where somebody's running from the left to the right, and then you make them a little closer, and they run from the right to the left.
Oh, yeah.
You know, planes flying. You never see them turn around.
And then the bad guys are chasing the good guys, and then the good guys are chasing the bad guys for one
brief.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I do love all those tropes.
There are a lot of, I mean, quality wise, that helps you eliminate a lot of shows because it's like the bad guy is over there in the cave.
Yeah.
And then
you have to know it's like any good, you know, piece of fiction. You want to know which character says it by just reading the line.
Yeah. Well, there's also a lot of spelling out like, they're taking our prisoner. There's a lot of stuff like that happening.
Hey, that was really good.
Thank you. Hal Loveland for Serpent Man number one. that was, of course, we all remember from Herculoid, the snake riders that appeared in town one time and stole the one woman that was part of the Herculoids and took her prisoner as she was picking berries. It's important to note here, as I mentioned that.
Yeah.
That you have to take a lot of these in the context
different
of the time.
Time
that they were made. There is a clip of Adamant meeting Karate Ant, which is a horrific chop suey characterization of an Asian person. But the same company also came out with The Adventures of Charlie Chan and the Chan Clan, which felt to me, and it's not my call to make as a white dude, but it felt to me more like representation because they didn't have the same sort of racist accents.
Mm-hmm.
And it was more like, hey, these are all capable people. They are a family and they are solving mysteries together. So that way, hopefully that's something that would inspire, somebody like a younger Asian American or Asian kid to feel like, oh, I'm seeing people like me on television. That's a good thing.
Right.
Okay. All right. I've got three.
Okay.
Do you want to?
I'll tell you what. I want to make people wait. We're going to take a quick commercial break here.
Okay.
So commercial break.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody's going to hear. Look, we are three cogs in the Max Fun machine, and we want you.
Somebody's got to grease those wheels.
Somebody's got to grease those wheels. We'll be right back.
What is up, people of the world?
Hello, hello.
Guess what? It is our favorite time of the year. Guess what time it is? Hal, do you know what time it is?
Of course I know what time it is. It's Max Fun Drive, Mark, you goof.
Yeah, it is. Here's how this works. For those of you who've listened to our show for a long time, you know that the Maximum Fun Network is a great big community, and we want to grow that community. So once a year, we have the Max Fun Drive, which is our pledging campaign once a year to get new membership into the Max Fun family. We put out some of our best shows of the year. We give great thank you gifts, which Hal will talk about later. Let's not put the cart before the horse on the gifts.
Yes.
This is mostly about celebrating Maximum Fun and the shows that you love on the Max Fun Network. This time, the Max Fun Drive, this time of year is the best time to sign up as a member. Or if you're already a member, hey, why not upgrade your membership?
Absolutely. This is the time of year that Mark and I talk about before it's happened. Like, what are we going to do this year? We're so excited. Who can we get ahead of time? You know, we want to roll out some extra special guests, maybe some really cool topics like the one you're listening to right now. And we're so excited and privileged to be able to bring it to you. But it's your support that helps the show keep going. So one of the reasons to support Maximum Fun and our show specifically is because you love the show, but there's also a good feeling you have, this feeling of pride and ownership when you're contributing directly to the people who make something that you love.
That's right. And we're trying to get more people involved in this family. We want more people to know about the shows that we love on the network. And we hope you love our show and when we'll bring more people to our show. This year, we're trying to get, dig this, Hal, 25,000 new and upgrading members.
Wow.
25,000.
That is huge.
That's a big tent. And it's a big, inclusive, awesome
friendly tent at Max Fun. Hal, you and I talk about this all the time.
Yes.
That is one of the absolute joys, specifically of our show, is that in a world rife with people arguing for real, it is really fun to go somewhere and argue for fake.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But here is how you can get involved. If you're new to the show, if you started listening in the last few months and you're not familiar with Maximum Fun Drive, but you do want to support the show, it's very, very easy to do. The way it works is it's a recurring monthly contribution on your behalf. So you go to MaximumFun.org/donate. It's .org, not .com. Take that .com. Throw it away.
Yeah.
I told you that on other shows.
We're an organization, not a company.
Yeah, we're an organized group of people. Mark, you're very organized.
Yeah, I'm super organized.
Like, more organized. I know if you listen to the show, you think Mark is not organized at all. You probably think he is barely, like, every day he wakes up, navigates what must be a maze of newspaper piles and cat skeletons to get to the bathroom.
Cat skeletons.
Which is also the dining room and the living room, and then goes out. But it's not true. He is a handyman. He keeps a very clean and organized department, and that is why we will only be associated with .org podcast networks like
yeah.
this one.
Yeah.
You go to MaximumFun.org/donate. As I was saying, we never get into tangents, though.
Not at all.
You go to MaximumFun.org/donate. You choose the membership level that's right for you. If $5 is good, if you want to forego a cup of coffee every month and do $5, that's great.
Also, you're paying too much for coffee.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Starbucks, I don't even know if you can get a whole coffee for $5. That's my new stand-up bit about how expensive coffee is. But you get to choose what's comfortable for you. $5, $10, $20, $35. It goes up and up and up. And hey, if you're somebody who is at the $5 level, but you're doing better this year and you want to upgrade.
Congratulations.
That's great. Congratulations. We're so happy for you. You choose the level that is right for you. You provide your credit card information, some basic info so that they know it's you. It is all very secure and it sets up a recurring monthly donation. You set it and forget it. But the most important part of this is you are asked what Max Fun shows you listen to. And the shows that you check off on that page are the ones that benefit directly from your contribution. So you
That's
have
right.
to make sure you check us off.
And we really do, in all honesty, benefit from your contributions. The contributions from the Max Fun Drive are, in all seriousness, what keep this show going. We travel a lot. We need gear. You know, to create a show, there's things that you need. And we'd like to thank the people of the world, this community, capital POTW people of the world, and yes. this community for giving us the opportunity to do this.
Absolutely. So we told you about it. There are some incredible gifts that we're going to tell you about later on in the show. But if you're already excited and you want to do it right now, pause this and go to MaximumFun.org/donate. Do it now while you're thinking about it. And then you don't have to do it again unless you upgrade next year. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. I have a terrible habit, Hal, of thinking I'm going to do this thing in the moment and really earnestly thinking I'm going to do it and then mm-hmm. completely forgetting about it. You know this from text messages and emails. Don't be like me,
don't
everybody.
Be like Mark.
No, don't be like me. Do it now while you're thinking about it. And then yes. Hal won't be mad at you later.
And I also want to point out, if you're someone listening right now and you're thinking, hey, I don't have the money to become a member right now, don't feel bad. Number one, we appreciate you listening and just participating in the community.
Absolutely.
But number two, you can share the Maximum Fun Drive with other people. Maybe you have a friend who likes the show and is thinking about becoming a member. You can encourage them to do that. Help us spread the word on social media. Tell your friends. Spread the word about the show. We really, really appreciate it. And thank you to everybody who supports us on a monthly basis right now. We wouldn't be here doing what we do without you. And we're so excited for what the next year is going to bring. We're going to have all sorts of fun stretch goals over the next 2 weeks for you. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
We will get to talking about some pledge gifts in just a little while. But in the meantime, let's get back to the episode.
Bye. All right, Clint, I've made mm-hmm. everybody wait long enough. You want to give us one of your finalists?
Yes, I will give you one of my finalists. I think I'll go with Johnny Quest.
Johnny Quest
in the adventure.
The adventures of Johnny Quest.
The adventure bucket.
Originally, the saga of Chip Ballou, believe it or not.
What puts Johnny Quest on your list?
All right, for one thing, I'm it's really hard for me to divorce my personal bias from this. Mm-hmm. But since I think everybody should think like me, I got no problem with throwing this out there. Johnny Quest came out in 1964. It was really the last of the primetime projects that Hanna-Barbera did. It was about this 10-year-old boy and his dad, who was the super scientist, Dr. Benton Quest, and their government-assigned bodyguard, Race Bannon, and his pal, Haji. And it was, when I was 10 years old, I was all about Tom Swift Jr., and I was all about high tech, and I was this big, huge spy fan. Mm-hmm. And when Johnny Quest came along, it was like nothing else on TV. Hanna-Barbera realized they could do things with animation that you just couldn't do with the special effects of the times when it came to live action or anything else. They went to a guy named Doug Wildey, who is a great comic book artist who had worked for just about everybody, and said, can you come up with this idea? Originally, based on they wanted to remake the radio series Jack Armstrong. Jack Armstrong, the all-American boy. And so, and Jack Armstrong was an old radio show that was just adventures all over. And he went, and that's what Johnny Quest did. His dad would be called on these missions, and he went all over the world. Wildey was a beautiful animator. As a matter of fact, he said the biggest problem he had on this show was the fact that the Hanna-Barbera guys could draw funny animals till the day, till the cows come home, but really had trouble animating real human figures. And they are full of action. They are full of these high tech devices and vehicles. And it didn't back away from, some of the episodes were honest to God, absolutely terrifying. And for me, that was the best. And they would run up against, invisible monsters, which was one of my favorite episodes, and werewolves and yetis, and they almost pulled the old trope of it being, it was just somebody in a Yeti costume. And then at the very end of the show, all the bad guys in Yeti costumes, who were really these terrorists, were wiped out. And
by a Yeti?
By a Yeti!
Oh! Turnabout! Look at that. I was waiting for them to take their Yeti masks off, be terrorists, and then take their terrorist masks off and be Yetis again.
That almost would work. Yeah. But like they went all over, they were globe-trotting adventurers.
Yeah.
And you got to see things. Nowadays, it's kind of commonplace. That's not such a big deal. But back then, they'd go to India and they would, go to the Antarctic. And the first episode was in the middle of the Sargasso Sea. And it was a real attempt to do real action. And it was the inspiration. Both Hanna and Barbera say that it inspired them to go on and create their more realistic stuff. This was like the beginning of their human period where they, went into, Space Ghost and, mm-hmm. Herculoids and Shazam and their Fantastic Four. And Johnny Quest was just a huge game changer. It just proved to be too expensive to do. They did one season of it, 26 episodes, mm-hmm. and they brought it back three or four different times, mm-hmm. and it's never gone out of syndication. It's never not been shown on a network. It inspired comic books and books. Some of the greatest, Steve Rude is a huge, Johnny Quest fan and on and on and on. And to me, it was the most original, boldest concept they ever had. And it's very difficult for me to divorce my personal feelings about it,
sure.
because I identified with it so much. But it was just a great a great series. Well, and that would be my first nominee.
Mark and I definitely owe it a debt because without Johnny Quest, that forms the backbone of the Venture Brothers.
Absolutely. Uh-huh.
Which has gainfully employed us for several years.
I just in this moment made the connection between Quest and Venture and the actual names.
Well, the funny thing is that Dr. Venture is the Johnny Quest of that show. He's just grown up.
Yeah.
His father was the great adventurer.
Of course.
He was the kid. He was like the famous kid. He was this famous kid who had all the adventures, and then he grew up to be a bitter. Oh man, God, so.
But I always thought that, and one of the things I loved about the Venture Brothers was I knew it was a pastiche of Johnny Quest, but you could watch it as an adventure.
Yeah, there's still legit amazing adventure stories.
Yeah, and great looking tech.
And this, so this was, I didn't really think about this before you mentioned it, that, this was a big shift for them. We talked about those seismic shifts, Johnny Quest being, the drawing actual, you know, characters that look like real humans. Because you don't look at Yogi Bear and go, that is a photorealistic bear, or look at Fred Flintstone and go, that man, might have a disease with the way that his body is shaped.
They had no necks back then.
Yeah, no kidding. That's why no necks and they fought, kids.
And the greatest theme song ever.
Yeah.
The greatest, and I mean of any theme song.
Please,
folks, the Flintstones is second. Johnny Quest theme song is the greatest theme song of anything ever written. And they came out, I think it was about 2 years ago, came out with a box set of all of the cuts and all of the takes. And the Johnny Quest theme song, the great story about that is that they were given Hoyt Curtin. They had like, it was almost an all brass ensemble with trumpets, trombones, and like four percussionists and a guitar and a bass.
Sure. It's like a marching band with a guitar and a bass added.
Yeah. And the guys in the trombone section were giving him a hard time. Yeah. You write, nobody can write tough trombone music. So if you listen to the first, like, I think it's about the fifth or sixth bar of the Johnny Quest theme, there's this section where the trombone guys cannot do it. Can't play it, and they left it in.
Oh, wow.
But it's the theme song, the voice work. Tim Matheson was the voice of Johnny Quest.
Look at that.
Otter.
Otter did the voice. Animal House.
Yeah, and there was a book, interview book with him called Johnny Sinbad Jr. and Me, and he talked about, he was 16 years old and was going into the studio with Mike Rhodes and Danny Bravo, who played Haji. And this was really the first time that Hanna-Barbera didn't hire voice actors like Don Messick, although Don Messick was eventually Dr. Quest and Bandit, the dog who I hated.
Wow.
But they were actual actors. Mike Rhode, who played Ray Spannon, looked like, Ray Spannon. He was a big tough guy from the Western. So that was a bit of a change for them as well, not to just go with just voice guys.
Right.
Yeah.
Because did they also shoot the recording sessions? Cause I know Disney, they would bring in people and,
I don't know.
Look at it. Like basically, mental mocap back in the day.
Well, they would rotoscope too.
Yeah.
Disney did that a lot.
Mm-hmm. There was some rotoscoping. They used what, I want to say xerography, but that wasn't necessarily in the Johnny Quest period.
There's a lot of the bands, they did that. Like it was too realistic and too smooth not to be rotoscoping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When they're playing the tambourine or working the neck of a guitar.
You don't know, man.
Making chord shapes.
Maybe there was one animator there who was like, look, I know we're only animating at 6 frames a second, but I can make a tambourine look like a tambourine. I'm guessing that the reason you wanted to talk about Hanna-Barbera cartoons, we are on separate ends of the country right now. I assume you are surrounded by this box set and an entire room of Johnny Quest stuff.
I have a box set. I should have turned the camera on. I have a model of the dragonfly.
Oh, wow.
Which is their plane, their rocket plane that they use. I, even as we speak, I have a bid on for an original cell from Johnny.
Hey, look at that.
But I understand the function of this program.
All right.
And I understand. I am open. I am open minded. And I have a couple of other suggestions but I'm going to wait.
All right.
But to me, it's a very important show.
That's a great nomination. Mark, what do you have?
I'm going to jump forward 5 years to a show that I think is a perfect combination of the adventure spirit and realistic animation of Johnny Quest mixed with the comedy of their former glory days of talking dogs doing antics. And I'm going to go with Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? My first. I mean, you can't deny the impact that Scooby-Doo has had on the culture. Maybe for me, this one's personal because I spent so long working at Universal Studios, and backstage there was always a mystery machine parked and Scooby-Doo and Shaggy and Daphne walking around.
I thought you were going to say, well, backstage Scooby-Doo would come visit and tell us stories about what it was like when he was shooting that TV show.
I was making TV. Yeah. It was very rude too. We were pioneers. Go get me a latte.
Oh yeah, he's a real jerk about his coffee. But yeah, it was the one that I was obsessed with as a kid. It's for all of the things that we have mentioned before, the camera work, the characters being so well drawn,
great
theme song, so well drawn that in their future iterations of them, those characters have been crafted by so many different writers, so many different actors. And will always be those characters. There will always be somebody embodying them. And that to me is exciting. A character that lives outside of its original version. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And look, and not only that, but it basically was the foundation for a whole nother animation company, because Joe Ruby and Ken Spears created Scooby-Doo for Hanna-Barbera, and they went off and formed Ruby Spears, you know, animation based on the strength of what they accomplished with Scooby-Doo. And man, look at all the spinoffs it's had.
Oh yeah. There are at least, there's a dozen pages of these. There are at least two full pages of spinoffs of Scooby-Doo. One point, against Scooby-Doo though, 1979. We have to ding it a little for the invention of Scrappy-Doo.
Scrappy-Doo. Yeah. Oh God.
Scrappy-Doo.
Come on, Uncle.
Yeah.
He's got puppy power.
Sure, he has puppy power. That's unrestrained Hanna-Barbera.
Nice try, Joe and Bill.
Yeah, that's the factory, getting too big and churning out too much. And every once in a while, you know, you create a product that every factory creates a product that needs a recall.
I want to be at the meeting where they go, you know, Scooby-Doo needs something for little kids.
This is much too sophisticated.
Yeah. We need somebody that they can relate to. The talking dog is too high concept for him. Give him a smaller one.
Hal, what do you got?
I have one. I just think it's very exciting in my childhood to see Superman, Batman, Robin, Wonder Woman, and Aquaman all together on the screen. I'm going to go with Super Friends.
Ta-da. Spoken like a true comic book gentleman.
Yeah. And of course, the original sidekicks were Marvin and Wendy, who had absolutely no superpowers.
Mm-hmm.
And was it Wonder Dog? Was that their dog?
Yes.
And then later on, you got Jan and Xana, the Wonder Twins, who could turn into things.
Wonder Twin powers activate. Came in what? That was like, which year? I'm trying to, I've got so
I think
many
that was Challenge of the Super Friends. Challenge of the late Super 70s. Friends.
Lots and lots of
but
Super
the original,
friends.
You had Marvin and Wendy, who had no powers but still wore outfits. Mm-hmm. Or Marvin did. Marvin wore a cape.
poor Marvin.
I just
no superpowers, but just
and he loved cape. Superman. He was supposedly like Superman's apprentice.
Mm-hmm. I don't know why Superman would string along a teenager like that, but beyond
to let him help.
I just think
it'd have to be on the DC Universe Channel now.
Yeah, exactly.
Take that, DC.
I just think it was a sort of a landmark piece for comic books into animation in a way that the Fantastic Four series wasn't, possibly because of or in spite of its inclusion of Herbie instead of the Human Torch was the one that was left out of the Fantastic Four cartoon. If
Herbie
I'm not
the Love Bug?
No, Herbie the robot.
H.E.H.E.R.B.I.E. Yeah. And I don't remember what it stands for, which, you know. That was a beautiful series, but oh God.
But yeah, we wanted Johnny Storm. Yeah. We didn't want, nobody asked for Herbie. Nobody asked for that, but I liked it.
For me, Super Friends really kicked in with the challenge of the Super Friends. I mean, yeah, that, sure. You know, because in that first season, it was almost always aliens or, you know, scientists that were not bad guys, just misled.
Yes.
And so, you know, I was such a huge comic book nerd. But when it kicked in with Challenge of the Super Friends and they added the Legion of Doom and yeah, there's Sinestro and there's, you know, Solomon Grundy, and it really took on more of a comic book feel to me, a superhero feel to me.
Once they got deeper into the collection of villains that they could pull from, I do like that they would, you know, pit. It's always fun to see villains get paired together. Like the superheroes getting paired together feels like a thing that I understand because Justice League and Super Friends and, you know, the Avengers and all this. But the villains all teaming up is a fun thing as well for it.
The Legion of Doom.
Yeah, the Legion of Doom. That to me is a great thing that this offered that other, like, I don't think about with other superhero team ups is, of course, really, supervillain team up.
They really tried hard for diversity. Eventually, I think they realized that, you know, it looked like, you know, the country club in the 60s and, you know,
right
in the deep south. And they added Apache Chief, Black Vulcan.
Yes.
El Dorado and Samurai. And which
all were, voiced by Mel Blanc,
probably. And then, you know, later on, they added other characters. They've got into a whole, you know, Dark Side, Apocalypse and Dark Side and Desaad and the whole thing. By that time, they had kind of moved away from, you know, the aliens and the bad scientists of the week.
Yeah.
They had really good voice work. I mean, you talk about people like Ted Knight.
Ted Knight.
Casey
Alan
Kasem.
Soul. Mm-hmm. Casey Kasem. Coming to you live as Robin. And also
as
Shaggy,
yeah.
Yeah, Casey showed up all over the place. He was on Josie and the Pussycats. And he was always.
Because he was just in front
of feet on the ground. And
that's right. Always reaching.
Couldn't get away from him.
All right. So what's next on your list? We've got three good contenders going in. Super Friends. We've got, Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? And Johnny Quest. What else should be on there, Clint?
I think the Flintstones have to be on that list.
Yeah, of course.
The Flintstones, because it was so important. While we mentioned before, Hanna and Barbera were great at spotting trends before they happened. That's one of the most important attributes you can have in anything in life. And I mean, for instance, when they launched Rough and Ready, which was their first real TV production, very few people had color TVs. And take it from a guy who was actually alive back in those halcyon days. There was no assertion that everybody was going to go color. Believe it or not, I mean, there was some folks who said, you know, sound in movies, that'll never last.
Man, that's the most overused trope in the Carousel of Progress. That'll last.
The world of tomorrow. Yeah.
History documentaries, they love using that whole it'll never last trope. I was like, oh, I get it. It's cute.
But they made the decision to make all their cartoons in color, even though there were very few color sets out there at that time. And I think they saw these trends, and it took a lot of guts and a lot of salesmanship to pitch a half-hour animated primetime TV series. And to make it about, I once read that the transition for them from theater movies. Remember, folks, cartoons used to be part of your evening out at the movie theaters.
Right. But this is when theaters used to just run everything continuous, right? It would just be, there was always a reel playing. You could walk in and out. You'd want to stay for the whole feature.
And it would run right into, there would be cartoons before the movie and maybe newsreels and stuff like that. And I'm really sounding like an old fart, but I can't help it because I am.
This, I love this stuff. Please.
But these cartoons would be little works of art, you know, and it wasn't really until Pixar started bringing it back, mm-hmm. you know, that anybody really, you know, did that. DreamWorks did some to some extent, but it used to be you'd go and there would be a totally unrelated cartoon. And that's where you saw cartoons, and they were beautifully drawn, wonderfully written, but they were basically sight gags for the most part. And right. Tom and Jerry was a huge success for them. They won Oscars. They won an Oscar for their first Tom and Jerry feature. They, you know, and so they recognized that when they went to TV, they had to move away from slapstick so much into still some physical gags.
Right.
But, you know, not sophisticated. I mean, sure. Yabba Dabba Doo is not sophisticated.
No.
But they knew they were going to have to make it more, you know, dialogue driven and character driven. And the Flintstones, yeah, maybe it was a takeoff on the Honeymooners, but it took on a life of its own. Lord, it ran a lot longer than the Honeymooners ever did. And I think it was just so brave and so important. And it showed, hey, you can run primetime cartoons.
Yeah.
I mean, let's face it, The Simpsons owe a lot to the Flintstones because that set the trend. Somebody would have done it before then, I'm sure, but you know, it was kind of a revolution. It was kind of a watermark. And then again, The Simpsons did the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, animation in prime time, you know, became huge again.
Yeah.
But the Flintstones really and truly, I think we owe a huge debt to them for that.
Well, it's like they domesticated the cartoon, not only in that they brought it into people's homes, but they domesticated it in the national sense of like they made it American because, you know, they're not writing like a cartoon was, to be, you know, for an international film audience, you know, where it's mostly sight gags and no dialogue like the Tom and Jerry cartoons with classical music playing while, characters, did antics that anyone from around the world could see. This was fast, loose, disposable American, jokes.
Yeah. Situational comedy.
Yeah.
Folks, we're back.
And we, as promised, are going to tell you all about our pledge gifts.
Yes, we are.
I didn't mean to say that kind of Oprah style, but I realized that it's as we are giving away gifts to an audience, you can't help but do this.
You can't help it, because if we had a bunch of people here who were new or upgrading members, we'd be like, you get a pledge gift. You get a pledge gift. Everybody gets a pledge gift.
Wait, what is a pledge gift, Hal? What pledge gifts can we get this year?
I'll tell you. This is at the $5 level. $5 mm-hmm. monthly membership gets you access to exclusive bonus content. This is not just our bonus content, but over 100 hours of bonus episodes. Yeah.
From every show on the Maximum Fun Network.
That's right. I can I say what ours is?
Are we allowed to say?
We're allowed to say. It's already out there because people who were previous members, they already have access to it.
Oh.
So if you're a member, just a monthly member, you will have access to this. People are already listening to it.
Well, tell them so that they don't miss it. They have to get to it now. People have already listened to it.
I don't 100% know if you know this, Mark, but I'm going to say what it is.
I know what it is.
Well, it's a special sort of after show.
You didn't think that I knew what
no,
this was?
No, I did, but the part that you don't know is that it's 2.5 hours long.
You know what? That's the part I guessed.
Because it's our producer, Ken Plume, who is a podcaster in his own right, along with, I guess we could say we got this super fan, but certainly somebody who listens to every episode.
And a dear friend of ours.
A dear friend.
And an incredibly talented artist.
Yes, Doc Hammer. From the Venture Brothers, a multiple time guest on our show, is the two of them. The goal was we're going to, in about an hour, we're going to do a review, a comprehensive review of all the decisions that the boys have made. In 2.5 hours, can you guess how many episodes they got through?
I'm guessing they got through 20.
25.
25. Hey, congratulations, yes. Ken and Doc. You got through 25 episodes.
That is pretty cool to have one half of the creative team behind the Venture Brothers and our producer, two people who know the show intimately, going off the rails discussing a show that goes off the rails.
I mean, it makes me very happy.
The only way you can hear it is at that $5 level. And we're going to jump up a few levels, but know this. Whatever level you move up to, you get all of the gifts that appear in previous levels.
And no matter what level you pledge at, we thank you.
Yes, we thank you. Thank you. Thank you. This is the $10 monthly membership. I love this. Year it's an enamel pin. This year the enamel pins are designed by Megan Lynn Cott, but this is the first time that we've been a part of it, that we've been able to have input into what the pins are.
Yeah.
So, we always,
so of
we
course
like the
we
pins.
Picked.
Yes.
Yeah, we've always loved the pins. But for this to be the first one that we got to have any input on, of course we wanted to do a Wrench Fight pin.
Yes. Yes. You people love Wrench Fight. This is from our first episode with Paul F. Tompkins, the calling versus texting, where we talked about the ancient Philadelphia tradition of wrench fighting. You get this really cool enamel wrench fight pin that is at the $10 level. You're already getting the bonus content. And by the way, if you got the pin last year, and you want this year's pin, you're going to have to upgrade your membership to get there. Just so you know, that is an upgrade gift only. But you will, of course, you already have the bonus content. But let's go up to that $20 level.
Ooh, at the $20 level, you will receive an 18x24-inch, 550-piece, beautiful, maximum fun puzzle. That's right. All you puzzle folks out there. And you know what? You know what is a great thing to do while you're listening to a podcast?
What's that?
A puzzle. A puzzle specifically designed by Jeffrey Tice for Max Fun Monthly members. The only way to get this beautiful puzzle is if you are a member of the Maximum Fun family.
Yes. And once you complete it, you will see what it looks like when you look out the window at Max Fun HQ. That is what it is. It's very cool. It's at sunset. You see the Max Fun rocket in the background. And speaking of the Max Fun rocket, Mark, you know what you get at $35 per month?
I bet you're going to tell me.
You know, if there are two things that Mark loves, it's podcasting and drinking. And every year there's a drinking vessel with that Max Fun rocket on it. And this year it is a glass coffee mug that is engraved with the rocket logo. And I've said this before, I don't like mugs in general because you can't really see what's in them, but the glass mug, perfect. I want to know what's I don't know if somebody's trying to poison me up in here.
It's a good point.
I don't know.
You're making a great point.
Exactly.
So look, whether you join at the $5 a month level and hear our exclusive bonus content from our wonderful producer, Ken Plume, and the fantastic Doc Hammer, or all the way up to the $35 a month level where you can get the glass Irish coffee mug, please think about joining the Maximum Fun family. And we thank you to those who are already members, and we welcome with open arms those who are coming into the fold now.
That's right.
And we thank you, thank you, thank you.
Here's what you do. There are actually higher levels even than 35, but rather than get into all that, here's what you can do. You can see them when you go to MaximumFun.org/donate. Here's how you get involved. You go to that website, MaximumFun.org/donate. You fill out your information. You give it the credit card information, a little bit of personal information, including.
You know what to do. If you're listening to a podcast, you know how to use the internet and have probably put a credit card in it before.
Exactly. But the thing you may not do everywhere you go is tell the website that you're visiting which podcasts you listen to. And this is the crucial part for us. Mm-hmm. When you are filling out that information, check the box for We Got This with Mark and Hal, because that is how our show benefits directly from the monthly contribution that you set up. If you do not check the box for us, we won't get it. And hey, thank you for backing the network if that's what you're choosing to do. But if you want our show to benefit directly, and I'm pretty sure you do, be sure to check the box for We Got This with Mark and Hal. And it is so exciting. So many gifts. Get involved.
It's amazing how much money last year that CAPTCHA podcast got, the one called I'm Not a Robot. Everyone clicked on that.
Well, you know, robots are taking over, Mark. It was only a matter of time before they started.
I can't believe I interrupted you to make that dumb joke.
I appreciated it. I liked seeing where it was going. But go get involved. And if you cannot become a member this year, that is okay. Help us spread the word. Help us find people who are able. And we appreciate you being involved no matter what. Thank you so much. And hey, should we get back to that show?
Let's get back to the episode.
All right, Hal, what's next on your list?
All right, I'm going to go – I think I have to go with Yogi Bear.
All right.
I have to go with Yogi Bear as a finalist. I just think he's one of those characters – it's weird to say he's lost in the shuffle, the Hanna-Barbera shuffle.
Sure.
He's certainly not the star he once was.
But he was the protagonist of the Universal ride.
But he's the protagonist of the Universal ride. There's something about him that's very charming.
Mm-hmm.
And just that classic, and who knows how many bear attacks he caused.
Right.
Just by kids going, yeah. He just wants some of my picnic basket.
He's a gentleman bear who wants a picnic.
Yeah. Sorry, Johnny. But now your hand is a hook.
None of those bears wore hats, which is always a tip off.
That's right.
Kids.
Right. Yeah. If but Grizzly kids, Man sure. had noticed that bear was not wearing a hat, maybe we wouldn't have the same ending to that movie.
Yeah, that's they teach you that when you go into a forest, if they say no hat but a tie, say goodbye, because that bear will attack you. That's bears figured it out. They're very smart, so they're like, "Oh, I'll put on a collar and tie."
There's a bumper sticker for you
right there. That's it.
Yeah, Yogi Bear was, and also if you want to talk about influencing, especially within Hanna-Barbera, Yogi Bear was the prototype of a creature at odds in his environment with an authority figure.
Yeah.
That was continued with like McGillagorilla and all those other ones that we mentioned before, because Yogi was, you know, always up against Ranger Smith. And I can't believe I'm actually saying this phrase. You can't discount Boo Boo.
Yeah.
You cannot discount Boo Boo. Some people to this day, you know, Yogi, you know, to this day loved Boo Boo, but it was a buddy show. It really, truly was. They were pals, and Yogi was this lovable rogue who basically was a felon.
Yeah.
I mean, he was, you know, he was smarter than the average bear, and he was and he really was the face of Hanna-Barbera for years and years and years.
Yeah.
I mean, you can still drive around this country and find Jellystone Parks because they licensed that, which was the park where Yogi lived.
Yeah.
There are all across the country, like trailer parks and campgrounds that are named after Jellystone Park.
I mean, Mickey got theme parks around the world. Yogi Bear got campsites.
Hey, Boo Boo, there's a
trailer
tornado
parks.
Coming.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think we should go to the storm cellar, Yogi.
And he was also the first big screen production for Hanna-Barbera. Hey There, It's Yogi Bear was the first full length movie made for theaters.
There you go.
That Hanna-Barbera made. A terrible flop.
But them swinging for the fences.
They were swinging for the fences. They went for it. Their second full-length feature was A Man Named Flintstone, which was a huge success, which was based on the Flintstones, and it was a spy,
James Bond spoof.
Which the greatest spy movie ever made. Mm-hmm. But that's another show.
Yeah,
sure.
But yeah, Hey There, It's Yogi Bear. He was very huge.
Mark.
All right. I have, this one's a bit of a cheat.
Okay.
But it was one that I loved growing up.
Just waiting for you to give bring one in that was a bit of a cheat.
This one's a bit of a cheat.
Sure.
Because I loved USA Cartoon Express as a kid, which was on the USA Network on Saturday mornings. And they would play the All-Star Laugh Olympics. The Laugh Olympics, it's a bit of a cheat because it's like the Avengers Infinity War of cartoons. it is an ultimate mashup of everything that they did. The Flintstones. It was basically the Olympics, but it was the good guys versus the bad guys from Huckleberry Hound, Quick Draw, Flintstones, Yogi Bear, Scooby Doo, the Grape Ape. I think even McGillagorilla got in there, and
yeah. You had Dastardly and Muttley from Wacky Races.
Can you do the laugh, Hal? Amazing. Yeah, Hong Kong Phooey was in there. And one that Hal and I were just talking about this morning before we started recording, Jabberjaw.
Yeah.
Jabberjaw.
Yeah,
they kind of reversed the whole thing where the kids were the sidekick of the animal.
Yeah. And it's just I never realized this as a kid, but Hal said, oh yeah, Shark Curly. And I went, what?
Yeah.
He was like, you never connected that it's just Curly from the Three Stooges, but in shark form.
Yeah. He says, whoop, 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 whoop.
I guess my kid brain did not connect the two things.
And when he gets scared, he goes,
or, yeah. Or no, maybe, I get it now, guys. I'm
maybe
a real
idiot. Just didn't want to.
Yeah. Maybe I didn't want to think that Hanna-Barbera just.
I want that, to be honest.
Yeah. That they just took every great, every, like the evolution of a character was vaudeville, radio, television, Hanna-Barbera cartoon.
Yeah. Clint, bring us home. Give us your third.
Well, you've already covered one of them.
Great. I mean, if I figured we would get to this point now where we would start overlapping. Is there any, before we, instead of just doing another round, why don't we just say, are there any that we have missed that we think that were in our personal top three? Mine got covered.
The only one that I would at least have us entertain, and mostly because of your recommendation of the Laugh Olympics, would be, I think, the progenitor of it, which was Wacky Races.
Sure.
And Wacky Races was influenced by an incredible movie, The Great Race, with mm-hmm. Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis.
Yeah.
And movies like
Mad
those
Mad
magnificent
World.
Men and their flying machines. Yeah, it was a cross-country race, and it was just a series of sketches. Dick Dastardly, Penelope Pitstop, the ant, was it the Ant Hill Gang? And it spun off into Perils of Penelope Pitstop and Dastardly and Muttley in their flying machines. And it was, I tell you what, I can remember I was probably 14 or 15 and still watching cartoons. We hadn't hit the line of demarcation for me, which was Josie and the Pussycats. That was the end of my watching. And I watched them all. No kidding. But you could watch Wacky Races and be amused by it.
Yeah.
You know, you weren't going to be challenged
Josie
by it.
Josie the Pussycats was just completely unamusing to you.
Well, I found it amusing in the fact that I found the villains more entertaining than the heroes.
Right.
And the music was good too.
Sure.
But
yeah, they're a great band.
Great band. Yeah. But by that time, I'm like 15 or 16. And if I went the next day and told people, hey, did you see the Pebbles and Bam Bam show? I was going to get, you know, physically assaulted.
Sure.
But
not nowadays, my friend. You can wear that shirt to school proudly.
Yeah. And you'll be very popular.
Right.
Wacky Races, maybe. I don't think we should add it to our list, but I think it would be. You know, maybe on the fringe of the top six or seven, maybe.
Okay.
All right.
Well, Hal, do you have your writing numbers on a page?
I'm figuring this out. So we have six finalists. I don't think I have anything else I would add.
I don't think I do.
We can do this a few different ways. We can take turns eliminating these.
Wait. I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Space Ghost.
Yeah.
Is it bad that I'm way more into the newer iteration of Space Ghost than the old one?
But that's
Space Ghost Coast to Coast.
That's part of it, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's that also, and Harvey Birdman, mm-hmm. but Birdman was really kind of a believe it or not, a knockoff of Space Ghost.
Right.
Space Ghost was a superhero in space, but they went to Alex Toth, one of the greatest illustrators of all time, and said, design, you know, this character. And, it's not going to win any awards for, you know, exciting plots. You're talking about 7-minute cartoons.
Yes.
Right.
Which they basically did the same plot, you know, every episode. But it was beautiful to see. It was awesome. And when I was a kid, Space Ghost to me was just a blast to see. About halfway through the run, I went, wait a minute. Didn't they just do that with Zorak? But I think that quality is what made Space Ghost Coast to Coast so funny.
Right.
Yeah.
Is the fact that, you know, that repetitive and everything else. But Space Ghost has to be at least in the conversation of top ones. But I think you can lump it all together.
Worth an honorable mention, or are we putting him up here on Mount Rushmore?
I wouldn't put it up on the Mount Rushmore. No, I wouldn't. Yeah. As much as I love Space Ghost, and, you know, again, if I had a camera, I'd show you my Space Ghost.
Oh my God, I love it.
Mock bust. So.
Space Ghost seems to me like the one that they came up with. One of them just said it to the other one in an elevator, and they're like, yeah. Okay, like there were just two things that were kind of in the world's mind at the time, because it was, you know, that era. And,
superheroes and
Bill just
space.
Turned to Joe and was like, ooh, Space Ghost.
Let's do
and
it.
And Joe was like, all right.
Yeah, 100%. All right. I think – so we have six here. There are a few things we can do. We can eliminate these one by one, and I'll leave this to you, Clint, which you would prefer. Or we can see if we have a consensus just out of these six right now.
I can see a top three. Is that or
yeah? Let's go to a top
would
three.
Would that be a step?
What would your top three?
Do you want to just all three say one simultaneously and see if we get three different ones to create a top three?
We can try that.
I love that.
All right. You ready?
Is it a matter of volume, timing, delivery?
We'll just go one, two, three,
always
the
and timing.
Then do it.
All right.
Okay. All right. Keeping all of these criteria in mind,
yes.
The best Hanna-Barbera. Okay. All right.
One, two, three.
Flintstones.
Scooby-Doo.
All right. So we're down to two. Two Scooby-Doos and a Flintstones.
Oh, God, Johnny. I'm so sorry.
Sorry, Johnny.
Down.
I know. Poor Johnny. I feel bad for Yogi Bear.
Yeah.
He's probably in jail by now, right? Don't you think – have they ever made a film where he and Top Cat are both in jail together and they break out?
Oh, we didn't even mention Top Cat. Top Cat was their first failure in primetime.
Yes.
It was a blatant ripoff of the Phil Silver show, the Sergeant Bilko. And matter of fact, even had some of the same voices doing characters.
But they did great with ripoffs. Hanna-Barbera, that was their stock and trade.
Yeah, it was these fast-talking cats, and they had a gang, and, yeah. And I was a kid going, oh, it's like Guys and Dolls, but cats, and it was terrible. Hate wanted to love it, couldn't stand it.
Luck was not a lady that night.
When you see a guy eating tuna from a can, you can bet that he's Top Cat. It wasn't a good theme song.
No.
No, this was the theme song. Top Cat, the undisputable Top Cat. Oh, some folks get to call him TC. No, I'm sorry.
Sorry, Mr. Curtin.
Yeah,
please
sorry,
see the
Hoyt. God, please. But folks, before we let Johnny Quest go by, please watch the Johnny Quest cartoon. Yeah. They are
and also
awesome.
The Venture Brothers.
Yeah, in that order.
Yes, exactly.
Well, no.
In that order.
Yeah, you better in that.
It's
order.
Better in that order, so you can see the material first.
All right. I think. Is it a matter of convincing you that it's Scooby Doo over the Flintstones, Hal?
You know, I don't know that I need to be convinced.
Interesting.
I don't. I thought honestly that we were going to have three different answers and we were going to arrive at Scooby-Doo anyway.
Yeah.
Because he's become he is the show.
He's
their most iconic character. He still lasts to this day. Yeah. And I know they're still making Flintstone stuff. They're like doing the WWE and Flintstones present Roxelmania. But Scooby-Doo is actively in production still. There's still Scooby-Doo being made.
Here's the strike against Flintstones, and that's tough for me because I really appreciate the historical contribution of the Flintstones, but when you look at the innovations and you look at the changes and you look at all the things that have happened, eventually the Flintstones just became parodies of the Flintstones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there were all these spinoff shows, but it was. If you really boil it down, it was kind of a one gag series. I know that they had great gags, but it was, oh, the mastodon baby's trunk is the hose to wash dishes. And you always had four or five of those in the show.
Yeah.
And Barney trying to get Fred's pebbles.
Yeah. Wait a minute. Now you need to really clarify what you mean by that. You mean the cereal, right?
Oh yeah. Okay. Shout out to the Flintstones also cornering the classic Hanna-Barbera does TV commercials on Saturday mornings. So even if you're watching anything else at some point, you're watching the Flintstones in the '80s.
Yeah.
And not only that, but for the first, the first 10 years of their existence, they would go out and get sponsors and then they would create shows,
mm-hmm.
really and truly. I mean, cereal companies. Can we mention the banana splits at the end of the show?
Let's go. Let's do it now. Cause we know what the answer is and I'll issue the decree that will seal it. But before we seal the records,
let me give you some weird stuff that you guys need to watch.
Okay. Please.
Pirates of the Dark Water.
Yes.
Okay.
Which was probably the last really, even though it's very derivative, the last really creative Hanna-Barbera cartoon. It's beautiful to see. It's like a fantasy, sci-fi, adventure mishmash that is just awesome. And if you look into Hanna-Barbera, they were always, these guys churned out ideas, some of them very derivative, but like they had a primetime variety show called the Hanna-Barbera Happy Hour, where they would have guests like, you know, Robert Conrad and Linda Lavin, and it was hosted by two life-size puppets named Honey and Sis. I don't know if you can ever find that, but if you can, watch it. The aforementioned Banana Splits, where they had four characters in costumes, and it was their
Sid and Marty Krofft homage, right?
Sid and Marty Krofft came after the Banana Splits. And Sid and Marty Krofft they always give credit to that, to the Banana Splits. And they did musical numbers and they ran around and they had all these great adventure cartoons in it, like the Three Musketeers and everything else. I want to mention also the New Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, where they combined live action actors playing Huck. Yeah. And Tom and Becky.
And wait. And they. And then like Song of the South style?
With them, the live action actors in an animated setting. And they would go to all these different fantasy places. I know this sounds like I'm making it up, but they got lost in the caves being pursued by Injun Joe, and they'd end up in a land with pirates, or they'd end up in a land with knights, and they'd end up in a land with monsters. And it's got to be seen to believe. And it was a prime time one. It was one of their prime time ones.
It's like Hanna-Barbera just had the world's biggest bulletin board and every color of note card you could imagine. And they just, and 1,000 of the note cards said werewolf. 1,000 of them said pirates. Like, they just basically went into what do kids like, shuffled up a deck of those nouns and threw them up against the wall.
But the one weirdo thing that you have to look up and find.
Okay.
It was a two-part show. One part aired on January 18th, 1979, one on January 25th.
Do you have a screen in front of you right now?
No, I've got a book in front of me I'm looking at this page.
I was going to say, if you just pulled these numbers straight out.
No. It's called Legends of the Superheroes. It is a live-action two live-action episodes with the Justice League.
Yeah.
They got Adam West and Burt Ward. And then they have Captain Marvel, Green Lantern, The Flash, Hawkman, Huntress, The Atom.
What is happening?
Black Canary. I want to say Howard Morris. Howard Morris was in it. Howard Morris was Dr. Savannah. And by the way, I know this is way after the fact, but Howard Morris was actually the person who played Dr. Little Ullman in High Anxiety.
Dr. Savannah sounds like a character on a soap opera.
Yeah. Dr. Savannah from Captain Marvel. Frank Gorshin was the Riddler. Ruth Buzzy, Ed McMahon, Pat Carroll. But here's the thing. The one episode was like this. I don't know. They're all meeting and they've got a crisis and they got to deal with the bad guys. And then the second one is a roast.
Yes.
A celebrity.
Yes. Of superheroes?
Yeah.
You have got to find this. I know I've got an old VHS somewhere of it, but Hanna-Barbera did this. It was after the Super Friends. It was kind of loosely based on the Super Friends, but you have got to see this just to sit there going, they did what? Are you kidding me? Weather Wizard is in it. It is absolutely remarkable. It just, you have to see it to believe.
All right.
All right. Well, you have your homework, people.
That's right.
People of the world. Scooby-Doo is a two-time winner. Scooby-Doo won Best Saturday Morning Cartoon.
Whoa!
Now has come back thanks to the expertise and encyclopedic knowledge of Clint McElroy, both in his mind and the encyclopedia he was referencing during this episode. Scooby-Doo is the greatest Hanna-Barbera cartoon and still going strong, like super strong. My friend Gray Griffin is, I believe she's the voice of Daphne. Is she Daphne now? She does
really?
She's either Daphne or, no, she's not Velma. Linda Cardellini, I think, does
Velma
still. But yeah, she's out there working.
Linda did it in the live action movies. Did she do it in the cartoons? Yeah,
and Matthew Lillard took over Shaggy for a time. I don't know if he still is doing.
Love Matthew Lillard.
But
and let's give credit to somebody who we have not mentioned. That's I will mess up the first name. Iwao Takamoto, who designed all the characters in Scooby Doo, and was kind of the visual creator of all the looks. They originally did it, and it was very dark and very scary, and the dog was like in the background, and the people at CBS said, we can't air this. Can you imagine that today? Yeah. We can't air this. And then when they brought Scooby to the forefront, that's what made it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the great Frank Welker, has been Fred, I think, for all time, and then took over as Scooby-Doo, and is like the king of creature voices, is whatever age he is, God bless him. He's still like working and brilliant and doing it all, but Scooby-Doo. Heard of it? Of course you have. You love it and you take it for granted. You don't even realize it's the best one.
Yeah.
You think of the smaller, you think of like Shirt Tails or Foo Fur or all those other weird. You think, there's somebody out there who's going to go, why didn't you talk about Wait Till My Father Gets Home? And my answer is, have you seen the haircuts on that show? We should have talked about it, but we didn't. The best Hanna-Barbera cartoon is Scooby-Doo, Clint McElroy.
I was really pushing for Johnny Quest, and I would have gotten away with it too if it hadn't been for those pissy kids.
Oh man.
Clint, thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure, guys.
This was a lot of fun. You are a blast to talk to about this stuff. You really know what you are talking about. What do you want the people out there? Where do you want them to find you? I feel like you've been plugging everyone's work but your own. Down to Pirates of the Dark Water.
I never know where to find us. Well, there's the Adventure Zone, of course, on Maximum Fun. We've got our second graphic novel coming out in July. Thank you all for buying the first one. I assume all of you did, or else, you know.
You're real jerks.
Yeah.
You're going to hear from me. We have a new a five-issue miniseries coming out with Marvel. In March called Journey into Mystery, which is part of the War of the Realms, Jason Aaron's War of the Realms massive tie-in. So,
so great.
Yeah. And McElroy, I think it's McElroyFamily.com. Oh, God, I'm going to get raked over the head.
Not by us. Don't worry about that.
Yeah. No. And listen, I've had a blast too. Have me back.
Yes.
For best classic Broadway musical.
All
right.
Because as much as I know about Hanna-Barbera, it's nothing compared to Broadway musical.
All right, you're coming back. Book it.
You're speaking my language.
This topic has been settled. There's so many more out there. Here's how you can tell us about it. You can email us at wegotthispodcast@gmail.com. You can go to the Facebook group, talk about Hanna-Barbera cartoons, share clips of the opening themes. Please, let's start a thread, facebook.com/groups/wegotthispodcast.
You can also reach out to us on Twitter @wegotthistweets or check out the Maximum Fun subreddit. A flame war could be happening right now.
Thank you to producer Ken Plume, researcher Kate McManus for the longest document I've ever read.
Well done,
that
Kate.
That was well done.
Yes.
Thank you. We really appreciated it. Graphic designer Uri Kelman and QA engineer Jen Alba.
And thank you, as always, to our musicians Jonathan Dinerstein and Mike Furman for our score and what we believe is the best theme song out there.
Yes.
Sorry, Hanna-Barbera dude, Mike Furman, for our score and theme song respectively. And thanks to you, our listeners. We want to just pile inside the mystery machine with all of you, eat snacks in the back, and go on adventures. So thanks for joining us for this adventure. Thanks to Clint. For Hal Lublin, I'm Mark Gagliardi.
For Mark Gagliardi, I'm Hal Lublin. And don't worry, everybody,
we got this.
We got this.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned,
audience supported.